I'm Duncan MacLeod, TechCentral's editor, and this is Meet the CIO, the show where we speak not to the vendors of technology or even the analysts who cover the sector, but rather the corporate users of technology themselves, the people tasked with using tech to grow their businesses. Meet the CIO is, of course, proudly sponsored by Wipro, and we thank Wipro for their support and their help bringing you these exciting interviews. Now, this is the final episode of season one of Meet the CIO. If you've missed any of the previous episodes, I do highly recommend going back and listening to them. We've had some great guests on season one of Meet the CIO. And we are going out with a great interview today. My guest in the studio is a CIO for corporate and investment banking and for payments at Nedbank. Her name is Marijke Guest. And she joins me in the TechCentral studio now. Marijke, welcome. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Duncan. Appreciate it.
We're going to be chatting about a very big project that Nedbank has been involved in the last little while, in fact, which you've been leading, and that is the modernization of the bank's core banking systems. Now, don't let that turn you off. This is actually quite an exciting topic. It might sound a little tedious, core banking, but it's actually a really interesting topic about how banks are run effectively in the modern age. And I'm really looking forward to delving into that in some detail. But Marijke, before we even get there, tell me a little bit about yourself. How long have you been with Nedbank? Have you always been into computers? What's your background?
I actually have not always been in IT.
Okay.
So when I studied, I studied for an industrial psychologist.
Okay.
And I became an industrial psychologist. And then I actually took an interest in doing non-profit work in education. So I was very, very passionate when I was young around education, and I still am. Mm-hmm. But I also found that without the corporate backing, you can't actually do good social investments. So I then started working in insurance and thereafter in banking. Mm-hmm. And in that, I got involved in card. I had the privilege of Nedbank sending me to Switzerland for 4 years,
nice.
Working with Credit Suisse and American Express. And in that, IT and payments are actually the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I started finding my love for payments and IT. And that's then when I moved into IT. And that was in 2000. I came back in 2005. And I've been in various roles within Nedbank, having the privilege ending up as the head of payments and the CIO for CIB.
Okay, but largely involved in the IT side of things for
very
that.
Very much. For three years.
Okay, so you've seen some CIOs come and go. I remember the first time I had a chance to talk to IT management at Nedbank, Barry Hall was CIO. He's moved on. I'm not sure where he is now, actually.
Oh, you know, he's very active, involved in the South African Reserve Bank modernization.
Oh, is that where he is now?
Yes.
Okay.
So this DHA pricing that went into the market and mm-hmm. that all the other banks had some concerns around, Barry Hall is leading the modernization of DHA, but also the DHA system. But also the South African Reserve Bank has this payment ecosystem modernization, and Barry Hall has been very involved in that.
Okay.
Barry was actually the guy who did the work in Switzerland. So, I had the privilege working with him.
Okay, fascinating. Yeah, he's flitted between corporate and public sector throughout his career.
Yes.
In fact, he was at SARS.
Yes.
He was a driving force behind
SARS. Digitization of e-filing. You're 100% right.
Yeah. And then I think he was involved in the launch of Discovery Bank. 100%
right. And then he went to the Reserve Bank to help with the payment modernization.
Okay, we must catch up with him at some point. But you must have seen, I mean, the banking industry and the IT that supports the banking industry has changed radically in the last 30 years. What did it look like when you joined Nedbank compared to what it is today?
Yeah, phenomenally. But I think in the last 8 years, it's actually been just the speed and the velocity of change has just mm-hmm. been compounded. So I think in the beginning, yes, absolutely. It was, we still talk to people who used to drive the ICB, the EFT transactions on tape with a little bike to the Reserve Bank. And then we started digitizing. And I think in the early 2000s, there was a lot of straight-through processing, Six Sigma practices adopted by banks. But I think in the last 8 years, where SWIFT started driving ISO and we started understanding faster payments in the world, I read a few weeks ago that there's now 56 countries who's got real-time payments mm-hmm. or faster payments adopted. And with ISO 22022 with real time and with faster payments, and then augmenting AI, Gen AI, and now even agentic AI.
Mm-hmm.
It has just, in the last 2-3 years, the demand on how you can scale, the demand on how you manage data and security and fraud and client experiences in a digital stack has just, it's almost as if every month you are asked to look at new capabilities and be able to plug and play in terms of keeping up with all those trends. So phenomenal. And you're learning agility. If you don't have a growth mindset, you will absolutely stay behind.
Yeah, fascinating. It's and the world is changing at such a rapid pace now. But banks also have a responsibility to protect their clients' investments, so they need to be very cautious about what they do. I mean, we're catapulting rapidly into this world of agentic AI and other types of AI and other technologies that are changing the world. It feels like at the most significant pace that certainly I remember in my career as a tech journalist, and that also spans about 30 years.
Yeah.
How do you ensure that you are at the cutting edge while also ensuring that you implement the best security practices and ensure that your clients are always protected?
I think you are 100% right. And one of the things, so firstly, and this is a culture thing, before you start with any frameworks,
because
our banks are good with frameworks and policies and risk forums and first line and second line defense. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a entrenched culture. And in Nedbank in particular, our saying is, we are money experts doing good. So within that, there is absolutely a philosophy that we are the custodians of the national payment system and the integrity thereof.
Mm.
So there's a country and a continent narrative. So it's not just a bank first narrative. There's a narrative that we are accountable for stability and integrity of this national payment system. And then, as you say, you have to make sure that you have the relevant risk policies, the relevant automated capabilities to monitor and to detect if you have any potential vulnerabilities, if you have data leakage. So security has become absolutely first and foremost. And I think we CIOs used to kind of not have specialists for security. What we are seeing now is, particularly as we move to the cloud, you need full stack engineers who understand security just as much as they understand their application and their domain. And I think then in addition to that, what we have learned in IT, and this is because of the cloud you can do that, is we have learned to rapidly learn, experiment in a very small part, because your IT landscape is no longer monolithic. So you have lots of little pieces that you can carve out and you can say, I can test and learn here. And if I see any vulnerabilities or any challenges, I can actually not harm any clients or any even operations. So that's how we've done it. So, and again, that pushes the whole culture around being able to fail and fail fast, fail forward.
I wanted to just touch on payments, but while you're chatting about it, before we get onto the core banking stuff, we obviously saw the launch. You mentioned rapid payments and how that's been launched in dozens of markets around the world, including here in South Africa, of course. PayShop is the product that was developed by BankServe Africa. There was some commentary just a few days ago from the Reserve Bank, from Lesetja Ganyaho, the governor, saying that they're a bit disappointed in the uptake of PayShop, that they felt it was going to be a lot quicker. Is that something that you share as Nedbank? And if it has been slow in being adopted, what's the reason?
We are disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are many reasons for this. And that is why the South African Reserve Bank started actually moving towards a payment ecosystem modernization. So there is amazing use cases, which actually, so we did quite an intense study around, so Nedbank did, but the industry also did. So I'll share with you what the industry learned from and lessons learned, but we also in Nedbank have learned some important components. But firstly, I think, as you know, in payments, if you do not have an ecosystem approach, closed loop can work, but it has a shelf life. So therefore, if all of us as banks do not work together, adoption will be slow. So we all need to learn how to move faster in getting our capabilities out and adopting. And something like a request to pay, where a merchant will push a payment and you literally now can just say yes or no, came 2 years after the first release. So that's, and that's something that, you know, large retailers where we work, for instance, with Spar or Checkers, have really been very interested in and saying, but that's the kind of stuff that will start making payments more frictionless. But I think, so what the Saab learned and what the PayShop community learned was, and we looked at other countries too, our data, our access to data and connectivity is still a challenge. So there are statistics which shows that if you go particularly to the rural areas, there's almost only about proper access, about 43% to connectivity and to data. So without that, you can't have digital. And we had a very interesting discussion with McDonald's, where they're trying to drive digitization within their franchise. But again, if people don't have data or access to data, they struggle with promoting digital adoption. And in that, they are trying to now see if they can't make Wi-Fi free. But I think that, and I know the Reserve Bank is understanding, how do we actually drive that infrastructure change? Then secondly, what is quite important is that in other countries, there was a consistent digital experience. If you go to every bank, there's different ways to click through it to go and find PayShop. So it's complex and it's not consistent. If we want to educate people, we want to allow for financial inclusivity, consistency is quite important from a digital experience. So that's something that didn't work well. And then lastly, pricing. Whilst it is far, far cheaper than real-time clearing, which is, of course, the real-time railways we are still running concurrently. It's now going to be sunset in November. We found that there's interchange, so banks cannot make it as cost-effective as they want to. But also, again, there were certain banks who really almost priced it the same as RTC, real-time clearing. So then if you want financial inclusivity, you need to make real-time payments affordable, and that wasn't there. In our own world, what we have started learning, because we have a very large juristic base, we have learned that if we can make these services available through APIs, and our corporates and our juristic clients, even small businesses.
What do you mean by juristic clients? You mean companies?
So, and yeah, so and even small merchants. So not, but you're right. So large retailers, you're not individuals, because there's even Stokvel's is a very good example of also what we call juristics.
Sure.
They, if they can get, so Stitch is a good example of who is using our APIs.
Oh, yes.
And if they can actually just consume it and then start using this service rather than EFT and rather than real-time clear, we are seeing that the adoption is getting better. So it's again that ecosystem play. Once we get our merchants and our companies to start adopting it, our clients will, of course, start saying, hey, ShopRite's got it. Let me go and find out.
It's a bit of a chicken and egg, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what we are now driving. And we've seen that that is successful in getting our consumers to adopt more.
I imagine the, there's very little data consumed in a PayShop transaction. Would it not just make sense for the banks to zero rate access so that consumers who don't even have data can use it?
So we've all used, there's not a single bank who has done it outside our apps. And as you're saying, your apps, you have to open up your app and that's then when you consume your data. NetBank was the only bank who used USSD and we have seen good use in USSD. But again, if it's an ecosystem, if other banks have not enabled USSD, then you only have a us and us. But on the us and us, we've seen and we were very proud to make USSD available because to your point, you don't need any data for that. And that also allows for financial inclusivity again.
Interesting. It's interesting to see how PayShop develops in the next few years, but it definitely does seem to have got off to a very slow start.
It has. And I think in that same article, which I think was on Tech Central, I remember, I was reading it. And on in that same article, it's absolutely true to say there's also additional features that Faster Payments has to start offering, and we've not even reached that roadmap. And I think that's why the Reserve Bank is now saying we're going to start actively driving it more so that we can make it more accessible.
Okay.
And sorry, and in that, bring in third-party access, because at the moment it was bank-alone access, whilst banks have built it to also have third parties like telcos, et cetera, use it. That is not open yet, and the Reserve Bank has all intent to open it because then it starts becoming more competitive, and competition always brings better
pricing. And the fintechs come in. And
that's the point. And then you have better competition I always believe competition brings more revenue. So I think it's good for them to be open and allow them to also start using that service.
Okay, interesting. I'm not sure all your colleagues at the other banks will necessarily agree with that perspective.
And not even in my own bank, everybody agrees with my opinion.
Okay.
No.
All right, let's chat about the core banking modernization. Now, I know you got involved in this project at a later stage when it was heading in the wrong direction.
Yes, I got the baton.
Hospital pass.
Yes.
Take us back, and I know this is before you got involved directly in it, but take us back to when Nedbank first started to talk about modernizing its core banking systems. What was the reason? What were you running then, and what did you need? What position did you need to get to?
So in 2012, between 2012 and 2014, and your listeners may say, sure, that's long, but in a bank, that is what happens if you have to do like over R1 billion investment. You have to do quite a lot of due diligence to
I think we should say that core banking system modernizations, and they've been done by a number of banks in South Africa, if not all of them over the years, is an extremely complex, involved project. And it has gone horribly wrong for some banks. I mean, we saw what happened at Standard Bank with the implementation of SAP.
You're right.
It was a disaster.
You're right.
You guys were heading in the wrong direction as well with this project.
Yeah.
Maybe just take us through what you were trying to achieve and why it wasn't going the right way initially.
Yeah. So, firstly, our attempt in the modernization was to say, we understand that we need to move to a real-time environment, and we also want to make sure that we had a common core banking platform that we could make available to all countries, not just to South Africa. So the biggest drive was real-time.
Mm-hmm.
It was really to start moving and matching your payment modernization, because in Nedbank, and I know not all banks do that, we distinguished between store of value, which is, of course, to your point, you put your money in a loan or in a deposit or in a transaction account, versus movement of value, which was the payment component. But even when we started becoming real-time in payments, our clients couldn't see their balances real-time. Our corporate clients couldn't go and understand, manage their liquidity properly because of real-time positions. And hence realizing that real-time unlocks better spend, and I am a Nedbank, very, very loyal Nedbank client, but I often also am quite cautious about, okay, what is my real card balance? Because I don't have a real-time balance. And in that, many clients are always unsure when do they reach their limits because it's not a real-time capability. And in that, I have my investments. Now I want to access, I release, I've got a 30-day notice period. I want to release it, and I don't have real-time.
So there's a lot of batch processing going on.
Lots.
All is running on a mainframe, I presume.
Huge. We are on the IBM mainframe.
You're still on IBM.
Right. We are still on IBM.
Still running mainframe.
Yeah, still, but in our new platform, there is a huge combination of many other technologies, which we were able to start doing in a year, because you're right, I inherited it in January last year.
Yes.
And our intent was still to do real time, but we started realizing that and it was in COBOL 4. It was a lot in COBOL 4. So what went wrong? I think you can very quickly fall into being busy. And not really, and because you have 5 years and you've got R1 billion, it sounds like a lot of time and a lot of money. And then you fall in almost into a sense of false security because you are busy, not productive. And so when I took it over and I had to talk to the teams, many of them couldn't explain to me, what does a core banking system do? And we were so used to, okay, we are just in COBOL 4, now we need to move to COBOL 6, that they didn't realize it's not about doing what we have today. I had the same discussion. AWS said they can do mainframe modernization. And I said to them, but I don't want to do mainframe modernization. I want to make sure we actually unlock new features for our clients, because core banking and the store of value have evolved. If you look at good core banking systems like DenX, they have made sure that they've simplified it to really a system of record, a good debit, and a good credit, and make sure that they attach all the other services, which is about moving and storing our value in a componentized way, which then allows you to say, I don't need this, I need that, I need these features, but these features are not for my segment or not for my product, which therefore allows your cost to serve to come much far more down, and your velocity, your speed of delivery, because we spoke about it earlier, the competitiveness of fintechs. Mm. We have had the fortune to look at some of our partnerships, and many of those fintechs deliver new features in 3 to 5 days.
Mm-hmm. And it's all, they're working in the cloud. And
absolutely. And it is working with lots and lots of thousands of transactions. And it's secure because they leverage a lot of cloud-native capabilities.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we need to match that whilst we need to make sure we are responsible, etc. Because to your point, I think one of the boring things, but the absolutely essential things is your core banking system also feeds your general ledger and therefore also feeds all the BA 900 numbers, which of course the SARB uses for market share, for a lot of other regulatory reporting. So we often just think, oh, it's my deposit product or my investment product or my loan. It's not. It is making sure that, to your point, there's proper capital provisioning, mm-hmm. that there is proper reporting to the Reserve Bank, and that there's integrity in our numbers showing that we actually have sufficient liquidity to run the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And those are often the things that gets not understood. And again, when I then took over, there were no understanding of the financial flows. How can you do a core banking system without understanding your financial flows? And that's not a technical, well, it's a technical team that needs to eventually do it. But you first need to go and really understand when you move to real time, you don't have batch.
Mm-hmm.
You have to move away from impersonal suspense accounts. In our retail environment alone, we have over 9,000 impersonal suspense accounts. So going through those steps, in addition to making sure that you get client benefits, was the complex thing to manage, and which we went wrong,
mm-hmm.
because we did not take the time to really optimize and straight through process things. We were just chugging along in core banking. It's just a store of value. Let's just make sure what we have today is what we have tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And when I walked in, one of the things that really guided us was looking at buy-in. Because buy-in is great standards, and it tells you what the services are that a store of value should offer. And then it starts becoming very clear. No, guys, we're not doing this. We're not doing that. This should be configurable components. If you want to go and start looking at a product,
mm-hmm.
you need to think about the capability and the ability to then allow for parameters to be changed, your pricing parameters, your negotiating pricing parameters, to be configured and given mm-hmm. to your business to manage, not the IT team.
At the point you came in last January, how long into the process was Nedbank already with this modernization?
So there's lots of percentages, but I mean, we were on different stages in terms of the different products, but we were.
But how long had you been working on it?
4 years.
4 years already into the project.
Yes, okay. So I had a year.
You had a year. Okay. So, I mean, this it sounds like this was a real potential crisis for Nedbank.
Yeah, it was.
I imagine you were getting. There was a lot of pressure on the IT teams from the board and from senior management.
Yes, there was.
And you were asked to step in when they realized that things were not going in the right direction.
Yes.
What was that first conversation like? I mean, what was that first conversation and what went through your mind?
So they didn't ask me. I put up my hand.
Okay.
So you saw that
this was going wrong.
Yes. So what happened was because I was driving payment modernization, my payment teams became increasingly frustrated
mm-hmm.
with the core banking team, not because at that point there was no thought leadership for real time. They haven't thought about how to solve for real time. And in particular, because I was looking after corporate and investment banking and real time liquidity positioning becoming so critical for our clients, it became increasingly important. So when, because we brought in PwC, they did a due diligence and they said, look, we are at a real crisis, as you said. And in that, I went to our CIO, Ray Nike, and I said to him, I'm happy to caretake it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the caretaking I fell in love with it.
Oh.
And I'm now permanently looking after it, yes.
Okay. So take us through what you found, what you changed, and how you delivered on this project in how long?
A year.
1 year?
A year.
How did you do it? What did you find, first of all,
yeah.
and then How did you fix it?
Yeah. So I think we found that people just thought rewriting a COBOL version from one COBOL version. COBOL is the language that is running on the mainframe.
I'm amazed you still run COBOL. It's a very, very, very old programming language. And I know some of the other banks, if not most of the other banks, also still run COBOL on mainframes.
Yes.
Was getting rid of this ancient programming language not an option?
Huge. Yeah, well, it's okay. So I went to my leadership and I said, look, if it was my choice, I would not have built this. Mm-hmm. I would have gone and partnered because there's good fourth gen platforms already there. But we were quite far down the road from a spend and a time perspective. And I then secondly said, I would most certainly not do it in COBOL.
Mm-hmm.
So I did get a mandate from not only our CIO, but also from our group Exco. The CFO was our sponsor, and sponsorships is very important.
Mm-hmm.
They said, wherever you can, let's make sure where we can bring in Java, where we can do in OpenShift, let's make sure we go and we write it in modern languages. But where we are, we're not going to totally now rewrite it. Mm-hmm. We will find ways of seeing what we can do. So we did use a lot of AI, and a lot of the code, which was in the old languages, we started using AI to help us translate into Java or into C.
Okay.
So.
And was the AI accurate at doing that?
No, there was lots of retries and and learn and forget and learn and forget and learn and forget, but the persistence in doing so really helped, and what also happened was unfortunately, because again. Your point is, core banking is not sexy. Core banking is not the digital team. I always say it's the fly boys. You know, they come onto the social media. Nobody puts a social media on. Hey, here's the core banking team. And usually core banking and payment teams also looks very tired because we work 24/7. Mm-hmm. So we never the pretty ones or the fancy ones or whatever.
You guys doing the grunt work behind the scenes.
Yeah, we're just making sure the GLs work. So, and we look after the money, but it's not a prestigious thing. And I know it's in all environments like that. So what I had to do, so they were very neglected, even in terms of understanding automation, understanding the power of getting automated pipelines, understanding how to, for instance, even use languages and then how to use, how to work the languages with the infrastructure. So that, for instance, you don't have to write queries, you can unlock queries or you can leverage SQL queries in different ways. So we went and we ran a very strong stream on engineering excellence because that was neglected.
Mm-hmm.
So we really had to make sure we drove that. And we had PwC help us, and they brought some distinguished engineers in. But it was coaching literally every day. It wasn't about PowerPoints. It wasn't about white papers. It was about looking at the code and then telling people, these 300,000 lines of code can go into 60 line of code. Let me show you. Mm-hmm. Let me explain to you. This is how you now, this is the Java opportunity. Even in getting Kafka, OpenShift, we had to get people who could coach and train. And what was amazing is, and it's a cultural thing, is how people started blossoming because people was like, oh, it's that core banking team. But the amount of wonderful technical competence, if you just invest and give them the necessary coaching and tools, was fantastic. Then secondly, we spoke about the highway. So we really started saying, guys, what happened was they also started having a product view. So they built My Goals, Everyday Banking. But every one of those products have to create interest, have to move money to card, have to. So we started saying, no, let's build highways rather than per product. And when we started moving to a capability-orientated build with the configurability of then doing products, of course, your reuse goes up significantly. But it took about 2 months of really going slow to be clear on what we're going to do there and pivot to that. And those, I think, were the two big things that we changed. What we also did was...
To get the fundamentals right first.
Absolutely.
Before you start building.
Absolutely. The architectural principles, the ability to do so. I have to be honest, we were 250 people who worked literally every night, every Saturday, every Sunday, every public holiday. Our last release went in on the 16th of December. So it wasn't that we just did normal working hours. What I kind of commend the team on was that on Saturdays, food always helps for IT people.
So we had pizza especially.
So we had wonderful, made sure that on Saturdays and Sundays, mm-hmm. we had good meals. And it was a buzz and an energy. But going back, we had to remind ourselves that we are the custodians of clients' money. Mm-hmm. And it really, it sounds so corny to say it was purpose-driven, but I really can tell you it was purpose-driven. These people knew it, they understood it, and I can tell you there was not a single person in the 240 people who was not committed and really, really just understanding how important it was for our clients and our operations. It was one of the most phenomenal opportunities in my life.
What did you learn from the project? Looking back, what, with the benefit of hindsight, what would you do differently? Mm. What would you say, that really worked well, but maybe that didn't work so well? Mm. We'd do this differently. I mean, a lot of other banks are still going to go through these sort of changes. Mm. I know you're not here to help your competition, but maybe a little bit of insight into some of the big learnings.
Yeah, I think particularly in lending, what we, in the others as well, but I still think we could have spent continuous time in really understanding what the capabilities are and embracing buy-in more. So we really did not, so buy-in is quite complex to adopt. And in that, some of the, so using a standard and a framework is great. It is still beneficial to really adopt that. Mm-hmm. And we did a hybrid. So if I go back, I would do that. And why would I do that now? In hindsight, when you have a culture of you build it, you run it, you own it, but you also have a year to deliver a project, you neglect, you run it, you own it, you love it. Mm-hmm. And I think that transition was quite a shock for us because we were like, kind of like, yay, we're over the finishing line. And then the whole team came back January like, hey. And I was like, guys, now commercialization and adoption is really important. And then it was like, okay, so now we're going to have another year of hard work. Mm-hmm. So I think we should have done more in making sure that because then we were like, we hardened. But as we started commercializing and adopting, we picked up that mm-hmm. there was still a lot of hardening, particularly with the rest of the bank and the channels. Mm. And that is something that I would suggest that as you near the end of the project, do more of. We did, but not enough. And I think that's the one thing. The most important thing I learned, and I keep telling my team that we have Monday stand-ups, skill, and talent. I just think we have a war for talent at the moment, globally. Mm-hmm. And that's to your point, even in... Because in core banking and in payments, it's not just about technical excellence. You have to understand the domain. Mm-hmm. If you do not understand the domain, you will not be able to give the operational and client benefits mm-hmm. that you need to achieve.
So you can't take an IT specialist out of manufacturing, for example, and expect them to thrive in banking.
No, not in core and payments. Mm-hmm. In other areas, which I also manage, you can. Mm-hmm. I would say markets, core banking, mm-hmm. and payments. That you, unless you have an exceptional learning agility, I just don't think that's possible. Okay. No.
Are you able to find COBOL developers?
No, and we've stopped looking.
You've stopped looking.
Yeah, we don't. We have really. We had such a gravitas that mm-hmm. we don't need. We have too many of the COBOL developers in our environment because we did a lot of modernization.
Yes.
So it's not just making sure that as we switch off, they maintain our legacy mm-hmm. applications because as we now migrate, of course, and adopt, we switch that off. So it's more about running than actually the new platforms.
Will you always have a mainframe on premises many industries are now moving wholesale to the cloud.
Hmm.
Is that something that's even possible in the Nedbank environment?
You are asking such an interesting question. And I think there are so many conflicting data points in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you would have asked me last year, I would have said, no, we are all going to go to cloud and mm-hmm. we are absolutely going to go there. But you asked some really important questions previously around security, reliability, mm-hmm. predictability. And what we are seeing is that everybody was very, very cloud focused, and we also have a strategy cloud first. But we have now changed it to say cloud first, we're commercially viable. Mm-hmm. What we have found is that, and just a very good example, so we have our real-time payments in Azure, our partner's ACI. But what we have found is that they have a real-time capability in the States. Mm-hmm. Their Azure instance have very different capabilities to what the South Africa Azure capabilities wow. are. So they, and even in AWS, because we are in both, what we are seeing is...
And you have to have local residency for your data?
It's better, mm-hmm. of course,
for
because
speed
of all the...
latency.
Yes, yeah. yes, and also for security, because mm-hmm. otherwise you need to... The Reserve Bank is always very... uncomfortable if you sit in if your data sits in Ireland or in, you have, you get the approval, but it's harder
yes.
to get that. And so what we have learned is that cloud, you have to be ready with your partners. And whilst our partners thought many of them were ready with software as a service, they were not. And platform as a service and infrastructure as a service is not giving the commercial benefits that we originally anticipated. So we have gone slower. So... and as you say, all banks have got four mainframes on-prem.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, mainframe is still reliable.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, it's just...
It's a workhorse.
Exactly. And for huge volumes and for large complex processing, it still makes sense. The challenge is that unless you are very, very good with integration
mm-hmm.
and finding facades to manage that, your integration to your digital channels becomes very costly.
Is that what used to be called middleware?
It's middleware.
Yeah.
It's middleware.
Right.
And that integration approach
mm-hmm.
is what then starts consuming, because it becomes very chatty, it becomes very data heavy,
mm-hmm.
whilst we've now started using Kafka endpoints to try and see if our data streaming cannot be easier.
Okay.
But IBM... also needs to get fit in some of those capabilities before. So, sorry, it's a long answer. So I think mainframe is here to stay longer than what we originally anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
I do think ultimately, as NetBank, we will move off the mainframe, but not in the period that people originally anticipated.
Okay. So another decade, maybe. Maybe even more.
I think so.
COBOL seems to be that programming language that never dies.
I agree. It keeps coming back. I do agree
like
with you. I agree with you. And I think what has happened is COBOL 6.4 has got new features, which is actually helping with making it more digitally fit.
Mm-hmm.
But I still believe our engineers is better equipped in Java and in many other languages that is leaning towards an environment for real time.
I know that IT people like to focus on the problem of IT, and very often, I shouldn't say very often, but sometimes the people, softer skills issues are overlooked.
Mm.
How important was people management through this whole process? And you said you had a team of, I think, 240 people. I think IT people can be a bit like journalists. So it's a bit like trying to hide herd cats. They're all going off in different directions in their own pet projects and all that sort of thing. How do you bring a team of 240 people together and pull them all in the same direction?
Yeah, I agree with you. People management, it's kind of like, let's just get the task done.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not all complain. If you complain, complain to your wife. And one of the things that was quite interesting was that when we started out with this team, there was an enormous fear of failure, because we knew we had a year, and their views was, well, if we don't make this year, are we all going to be fired?
Mm-hmm.
Because this was that important for NetBank.
Mm-hmm.
And
so the pressure was on.
Yeah. So the first thing was to really, and I changed the whole leadership team, literally the whole leadership team. And I brought in very different, a diverse set of people, quite tenacious and resilient, but all with different vantage points and thoughts. So the biggest thing was to make sure that you have the right leadership team. And they had to be brave. But they also, to your point, had to understand that we had to focus on our people, their well-being. We had wonderful HR partners who made sure that we had little care packages. We had masseuse coming in and massaging them. And so we really, really did a lot to make sure that we had well-being supporting them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also had important partners in my wider exco. So my infrastructure and operations colleagues, my data colleagues. they really had to show up so that my teams felt supported when they needed extra capacity in the testing environment, et cetera, et cetera. So it was truly a team effort. I don't think it was what you said. I think people underestimate the profound impact because it's got tentacles everywhere in the bank.
Mm.
The impact of modernization. And if you have wonderful partnerships and collaboration, yeah, and sometimes you fight, but if you get there, I think that is what makes success. And that's soft skills, collaboration, having a one net bank mindset, making sure we all work towards the same objective, and then having strong leaders to keep the teams there. And that was to your point. At one point, we just had to stop because people would still have people doing favors on the side.
Right.
And we had to start just making sure we monitor that to just say, no, this is what we're focusing on. And one of the big important lessons, and you know it, but when you see it in action, you're just like, wow, that's such a great theory. As you know, Agile became, actually in 1980, there was thought leadership around Agile. And minimizing work in progress is really one of the most important principles. But when you, because context switching always makes sure, you know, you don't get to deliver value. And it was to your point, that ability to really limit those people's work in progress and limit their context switching, their mental health also started becoming better, and they on their own started realizing the habits of not just doing all favors and really focusing on the highway.
Do you think your background in organizational psychology helped you lead, deliver this project on time?
You know, I sometimes wonder about it. What I can tell you is that when I left school, I was 16, and I finished matric. My mother, I think I was hyperactive, so I think my mother decided, look, this lady is going to school at 4, because I was just too busy. So I finished, and I didn't know what I want to do. I wonder if I wouldn't have done IT if I knew about, I grew up in a very small rural environment.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think I knew what the world was about.
Where is rural?
Vryheid in KwaZulu-Natal.
Oh, right.
So we were two people who went to university from the whole town. So it was like, wow, these two people. So my answer is, I think it may have helped, but in my personality, I think I'm not an industrial psychologist. I am an IT person at heart, but highly analytical.
Mm-hmm.
So more on, because I think people also think IT is just about writing code. IT is being able to conceptualize a solution, listening to what you need to do, and being able to break it down. One of the interesting things, to your point in the middleware space, with microservices, what we have now seen is your IT competence is of a lesser importance than really understanding what is the domain and breaking those microservices into services that works for the domain. So an account balance, statement inquiry. And that part, I see a lot of my people who are really brilliant at writing code struggling with. And that's where my mind works. Mm-hmm. And then I have wonderful engineers who can help me with the rest of the engineering.
Okay. So the project's wrapped up. You're still doing some post-implementation work to enhance the commercial services that you offer.
Yeah, will now be ongoing.
But where, just take me through where, from a business perspective, where this has put Nedbank today compared to where it was prior to the project. What can Nedbank do today that it couldn't do before?
You are right. We are busy migrating. So if some of your listeners are not there yet, it's because we are not fully there yet. But the biggest opportunity is that our clients will now have real-time access. So if they want to move money from one account to another, it will be, so as an example, from an investment to savings account, you will be able to do it real-time, but see it real-time on your digital properties. And for our clients, we are busy now implementing, because we need more work than just the core banking component, we are busy creating real-time liquidity positioning, which of course helps them with working better with their working capital, making sure that their liquidity position is far more optimal, because cost of all of those cash and capital comes at a price. And then what the clients will also be able to do is therefore be able to feel more safe, because real time also helps not with fraud, being able to catch it better, because your clients will be able to see, hang on, and I have a balance which I didn't do, or a payment which I didn't do, rather than having to look at the statement 2, 3, 4 days in advance, later. And then for NetBank, what we are doing is we will therefore able be, and this is more for clients in distress, our ability to manage collections and understand our clients' position and whether they need financial help or not will, of course, also be in a far better position, because we will understand what, again, where they are and whether they are in distress, and reach out rather than moving them in a hardcore collection bucket and calling them and going to make them feel as if they are financially bad at managing their positions. So those are the big things that we will see from a benefit perspective.
Does it also allow you to compete more effectively with new challenges like the so-called neobanks and the fintech players?
Absolutely.
And start to offer products and services that compete with with those guys?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So now, for instance, we are seeing even in our real-time payments world that because we now have a real-time system of record as well, we are able, firstly, our velocity is now configuration. Mm-hmm. So our velocity, we even in our innovation spend, it has dropped 5 times. So, yes, we are able. We are not still at 3 to 5 days, but we are getting there. And that absolutely is the biggest thing. It's configurable, and it speed to market has and cost to serve have dramatically changed. You're absolutely right. And that is where the neobanks are really good at. Yeah. Even some of the fintechs, you look at, because to your point, they've built everything cloud natively. So they can run at a 30% cost to income ratio. Our biggest challenge is now switching off all that old stuff, because if you're going to start continue running concurrent, your cost to serve is never going to get to the level that a 30% cost to income ratio will be.
I know that historically Nedbank has always had one of the better cost to income ratios in the banking sector. I haven't looked at it in a long time, though.
No, it's not as good at the moment.
Not as good. Is that because of project costs and everything?
So I think it is because we are trying to find... So yes, IT is a part of it, but I think we are also finding the balance around how do we start pushing digital adoption versus how do we create warm digital? So we are talking digital when you want it, but a person when you need it. And that is where we are still finding a balance. So you would have seen many of our other competitive banks have shrunk their branch network.
Yes.
We have not. They've shrunk the ATM network. We have not. So we have really focused on our client accessibility, et cetera. But it is important that we also drive digital adoption. And in our juristic world, as an example, we have jumped from 56,000 clients to 94,000 clients in the last 6 months. And I think as we put more digital features on, and that's part of why you need to modernize payments and core banking, as you can start allowing for digital services on your digital platforms, because you now have a digital at the core capability, you can start doing that. Yes.
Something that caught my attention was that you now offer tokenized settlements and programmable payments. What does that mean? Is tokenized settlements related to cryptocurrency?
Yes, we do, but it's in a test and learn phase.
Right.
But yes, it's absolutely so. So we have a digital custody, and we are allowing for blockchain. But it is in a highly contained
environment.
Yeah, because again, to your point, and to your point around our responsibility from a governance perspective, we had to get approval from the Reserve Bank, and it is in a proof of concept component. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And
does that include stable coins?
We have not explored stable coins. We have a position in the bank on stable coins, but and we're monitoring it very closely. And we think there's going to be value. And we know the Reserve Bank is actively also looking at how... what the value would be for South Africa. But I also know, talking to some senior people in the Reserve Bank, they are trying to put this next to the real-time payments, the faster payments work that is not PayShop, but the enhanced faster payment work. And they are saying, what will be achieved if we add some of that? But I know there are some discussions, so we're monitoring it, but we have not tested and learned on that.
I was just curious, because I know the big US banks are all talking about launching their own stable coins now, which is fascinating.
I know, and I think there's lots of learnings that's coming out. I want to see every day good learnings and position papers coming out from the US. I think it is important that South Africa starts formulating. There's for me two things that we really need to do better on. We need to get to a PSD, to a standard API standard and integration pattern for all the banks, because at the moment it works on bilaterals, and that will allow for financial inclusion and also for opening up for third parties again to for fintechs as well as for telcos, etc., to start participating in the ecosystem. And then I do think we need to now get a firm position on crypto holistically. I don't know if you do know, we did use DLT in our, sorry, distributed ledger technology with Saab in Corka. We were one of the banks who
Project
did that.
Corka, yeah.
Yes, and that was fantastic. We saw that it worked. So I think there's really opportunity to even move real time in the industry. But in South Africa, we are very much like the national government. The unity of what the
GNU.
Thank you. The government, because
GNU.
Yes,
yeah.
Thank you. Because the banks also have very strong varying views, and because we often therefore cannot all get to a common understanding, we move slower than many other countries. So I think we kind of need to find a way to overcome that.
Okay, I just want to come back to the programmable payments. What is that?
So that means that our clients can actually go and create payment permutations in a democratized way, and we will check the guardrails so that they can have different payment capabilities, and they can do, like, as an example, we call it low-cost routing. They can help with actually making sure that the right route for payments is being opted for, but in a way that is configurable.
So it's kind of an API that you expose to your clients that they can then use to do things. Okay, fascinating. Right, you, Mareki, you were ultimately awarded Nedbank's Chief Executive Award for your work done on this project. Are your days a bit easier now compared to last year? Or are you still hectic?
We are hectic. Yeah. We I think in IT, particularly where we are at the moment, we are still very, very busy. But I also think in IT, if you do become very relaxed and you do not work at the speed, you unfortunately are not going to remain competitive. We spoke about, I think our biggest adoption at the moment is now really making sure we understand the power of AI, Gen AI, and in particular, we are doing a lot on agentic AI.
Interesting. So, yeah. So not just around code and code rewriting and that sort of thing. What sort of AI agents are you looking at?
So firstly, we are, believe it or not, we have agentic AI. So what we have done is we call it eye to eye, idea to implementation. We partnered with McKinsey to help us create that. And the agentic AI is a full stack team. So we actually have an agent who is a BA, an agent who writes code, an agent who tests the code.
Okay.
And we actually have done our first proof of concept very successfully. They implemented the use case for trade and trade finance. So it's a virtual squad, but they are all agents. So they are actually, we are from idea to implementation using agentic AI.
Amazing.
What we have also done in agentic AI is in our, I look after HR.
Yeah.
We are busy working with ServiceNow, and they have fantastic AI agents. What we will do is we will help digitize. There's about 71% of our employee servicing that can be done in a very nice way without asking a HR business partner. But at the moment, we are very manually intensive, and we have started building that. It's not live yet, but the power and the immense opportunities are very exciting. You did say earlier, and you are right, getting it right is taking time. As an example, in trade and trade finance, we are using a Gen AI to take the 27 documents that you need to do for all the checking, etc., and we are moving it into intelligent character recognition. But what we found was that our prompts were really, really, we took time to write our prompts. And that's what we keep seeing now, that our prompts are really what is going to make your AI good or not. And what we had to do, and we are still doing it, is running our Gen AI automation in trade and trade finance with people.
Mm-hmm.
And every day we compare so that there's no illusions or there's no ability to slip in fraud or incorrect information or bypass some of the regulatory checks. And that's the same in the HR space. So whilst it sounds amazing, it is small steps,
mm-hmm.
and it takes, we underestimated the intelligence that's required for prompts. And therefore, when people say, oh, AI is going to take over your job, if you understand your domain and you know how to create the rules, somebody still needs to create the rules.
Someone has to talk to the AI.
Yes.
Where's this going from a consumer perspective? Will I at some point be able to, say, fire up a Nedbank agent in WhatsApp and say with my voice, transfer 10,000 Rand from my check account to my credit card, and it does it?
Yes, watch the space. We are literally busy with that now.
Okay.
So within Nedbank, we call it Digi2. We're calling it App X.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say more, but early in Q1, yes.
Watch the space. Sounds interesting.
We want to leapfrog, and we want to have the best digital payment experience in Africa in Q1.
Mm.
And we are busy building now. So okay. We believe
Q1 next year is the
yes.
time to
please
watch.
Look out for it.
Right.
And as I said, you already have your green jacket, so you are welcome to become a Nedbank client.
Completely coincidental, but
we will absolutely invite you to become part of being one of our friendlies when we test it.
Mareike Guest is CIO, Corporate and Investment Banking and Payments at Nedbank. It's been a fantastic discussion. Thanks for your time on Meet the CIO today. It's much appreciated.
Thank you for the opportunity, Duncan. It was wonderful.
Pleasure. Thank you.